Hi, I'm Marvin Olney, host of To The Point in Which Way LA, and thanks so much for listening to our programs. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film awards season, I've got a podcast for you to check out. It's called The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. He goes beyond the plot to understand what inspires the actors, the filmmakers, the producers, and others to do what they do. You can find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Measles makes a comeback at Disneyland. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Measles is highly contagious. It can lead to pneumonia, lifelong brain damage, deafness, and even death. 15 years ago, MMR, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, was thought to have eradicated measles in the United States. But today, more than 70 people in California and 5 other states have come down with measles, an outbreak that started at the happiest place on Earth. Was it spread by visitors from other countries? Are too many Americans saying no to the MMR vaccine? Today's talking point, can Facebook crack down on fake news without silencing satire? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. 15 years after measles was declared eliminated in the United States, more than 70 people have come down with the disease, an outbreak that started at Disneyland. It's not enough cases to be a real epidemic, but public health officials are warning that too many people are refusing the vaccination that once eliminated a highly contagious, potentially deadly disease. Today's talking point, Facebook, has become a source of fake stories masquerading as news, and that's a threat to Facebook's credibility. Now it's asking Facebook users to separate fact from fiction. First, this news update. The 90-year-old king of Saudi Arabia died yesterday. He'll be replaced immediately by his 79-year-old brother. Today, the leader for the next generation was also announced. Rachel Bronson is senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, author of the book Thicker Than Oil, America's Uneasy Partnership with Saudi Arabia. Rachel Bronson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So who will be the successor to the successor?
Oh, we have a successor to the successor to the successor. This is actually very, very big news. We have now King Salman, and power has transferred easily and seamlessly to King Salman. And we also have a crown prince, and so a Prince Mukran. So this is a country where people always look at and say, who's going to be next? And yet power has, over the decades, transferred very peacefully. So we have a transfer from King Abdullah to King Salman. It will eventually go to Crown Prince Mukran. But the real biggest news of the day is that the deputy crown prince, the person who will succeed the successor, has been named, and that's a man named Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. Why that's so important, and it really is probably King Abdullah's greatest legacy, what he'll leave behind to, and what he'll be remembered for, is that Prince Mohammed bin Nayef is a grandson of the founder. Until now, power went from the original founder to his sons. So modern Saudi Arabia really has only been ruled by the founder and his sons. And the question for Saudi watchers has always been, how will it possibly change to the next generation? How could that happen peacefully? What will the mechanisms be? And King Abdullah has left that question now answered. The first grandson of the founder who will rule the kingdom will be Prince Mohammed bin Nayef.
There are many other grandsons, as I understand it. Is there a possibility that any of them will challenge this decision?
There's always possibilities for challenge. What's so interesting about the founder, he had 44 sons, so that's why we're able to go through so many sons. And so it will be from Salman to his last remaining son, Prince Mukran, who is now in his mid-60s. So there's always a possibility for challenge, but the precedent is not there. The Saudis decide their leadership transition very privately, but once designations such as crown prince and deputy crown prince come out, they have not been challenged. So it's always possible, of course, but there's no precedent for it. And Mohammed bin Nayef is an extremely powerful man as it is. He's currently the interior minister. His father was the interior minister before him. He has worked very, very closely with the United States and others, so he's well known internationally. And domestically, he's worked on counterterrorism operations, so he knows the extremist groups to the right. He knows the more liberal voices. He knows his domestic constituency very, very well. So he's a very powerful person, and certainly if challenged, would be a force to be reckoned with.
How is Saudi Arabia affected, particularly when there's a change of power, by what's going on next door in Yemen?
Yeah, so thank you for raising that. Yemen, you know, the fact that there was a coup yesterday and this transition today is very unsettling for Saudi Arabia. You know, Yemen is a country we might not think much about, but in Saudi Arabia, Iran is the existential threat, and Yemen is one that that preoccupies them. And it's where bin Laden's family comes from, and a lot, it's a poor and a relatively populous country. So the Saudi leadership, the current king, King Salman, this will be his first international challenge of how, what to do and how to manage Yemen. The coup led by the Houthis are a group that Saudi Arabia will see through sectarian lenses. They will see that as an Iranian ally, the Houthis they see as receiving support from the Iranians, and they will see this as yet another challenge from the Iranians to the Saudis in their neighborhood. So in addition to ISIS and what's going on in Syria, add now Yemen to Saudi Arabia's many challenges. For Saudi Arabia, the leadership sees it very similarly. So the leadership is pretty united in seeing this as sectarian warfare vis-a-vis Iran. So there's not a lot of difference. I'm not expecting great differences. And the United States is very concerned about this coup. And so you'll see immediate close working relations with the United States on that, which in some way is probably pretty good for this for this moment for Salman when he's taking over, to have a moment where he can work easily and quickly and closely with the Americans.
Very quickly. Any idea that there will be any change in the price of oil?
You know, because the low price of oil is hurting Iran first and foremost, I think Saudi leadership is pretty comfortable keeping it low. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on our program. Rachel Bronson, again, at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, author of Thicker Than Oil, America's Uneasy Partnership with Saudi Arabia. We'll pick up on that, of course, in later programs. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, measles makes a comeback at Disneyland on To The Point.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Norman Olney back with To The Point. 50 years ago, there were 3 to 4 million cases of measles every year in the United States and 400 or 500 deaths. By the year 2000, vaccination had become so effective and so common that the highly contagious disease was declared eliminated in this country. But last year, there were 644 cases, and today, at least 70 people have measles in an outbreak said to have started at Disneyland during 4 days in December. Laurie Garrett is Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Her books include I Heard the Sirens Scream. Laurie Garrett, it's always a pleasure to have you on our program. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Warren.
You keep a map, as I understand it, of measles vaccinations. What does it show?
Well, we have an interactive vaccine-preventable disease map at www.cfr.org. We've been tracking outbreaks of vaccine-preventable, the key six childhood diseases around the world since 2008, updating it every single week. And what you see since January 1st of this year, if you just look at 2015, is that almost all the measles in the world is in the United States, and most of that is in the great state of California.
So this would then be traceable, I assume, to this outbreak that began at Disneyland.
Yes, and to a still lingering outbreak in Orange County that started in 2014 separately from the Disneyland case.
What are public officials doing, or what do you attribute the outbreak to? Let me ask you that first.
Well, very interesting problem that we have in the United States is twofold. One, we have constant importations of isolated individual cases of not just measles, but pertussis, diphtheria, other sure. key vaccine-preventable diseases. And it's usually a traveler, somebody, an American who goes overseas and comes back having acquired an infection overseas. And then if they get into most of these middle-class communities where there's a high level of parental refusal to vaccinate their children for one reason or another, the index case can result in a large number of transmissions. And we now can see that this can be exacerbated in what we call nosocomial transmission, which means spread of illness inside of hospital settings, because there's now a fair rate of refusal among secondary tier hospital workers refusing to get vaccinated themselves. So they can become vehicles of further spread once an infected child comes in for treatment.
So the idea then that people don't need to get vaccinations is spreading. Where does it come from?
Well, this really originated with a fellow named Andrew Wakefield, who used to be a physician but lost his license in the UK because he published studies now known to be bogus and for which he has been severely chastised by medical authorities at all levels in his home country, the United Kingdom, in which he claimed to demonstrate that boys who received the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine had a higher likelihood of ending up autistic compared to boys who did not receive that vaccine. And as I said, that's been thoroughly debunked, and yet it's proven very, very difficult to stop the spread of these conspiratorial views that vaccines somehow contain things that will damage your child. And I have to say, having held a child in my arms in 1979 who died in my arms of measles, I cannot think of anything more harmful than not vaccinating your children. And if you have any doubt about how severe and horrible measles can be, I would urge you to take a look at these cases. It's interesting. There was just this interesting study published in which in the UK, because there's been such a high level of vaccine refusal there because of Andrew Wakefield and his legacy in that country, they looked at 500 people who had actually suffered measles in 2013 and 2014 in the UK. And the average person lost 10 days of work and or school. A third of them suffered acute depression that lingered long after they thought they were well. 20% went through a period of several days of absolutely zero mobility, close to paralysis, not just bedridden, but just really couldn't get out of bed. Measles is not a trivial disease. When I lived in Africa the first time in 1979, measles was the number one killer of African children. You didn't have to look far at all to see children gasping and dying of that disease. Today, Africa has taken elimination of measles much more seriously than have Americans. They have reduced the incidence and the death mortality rate from measles across the entire African continent by 98% since 1990. In the United States, our measles rates in the same time period have been going up.
This is even though the disease was thought to have been eliminated here in the year 2000. What about doctors who by the idea that Andrew Wakefield was, in fact, guilty of spreading bogus information, but still believe that parents ought to have a choice as to whether they and to when they vaccinate their children. There seems to be an issue about timing.
Well, the new sort of vogue anti-vaccine dogma is that there are, quote, too many vaccines, and that they shouldn't all be given to children in the same rough time period, and somehow children's bodies can't accommodate all these assaults. But I would remind people that very, very healthy children, the healthiest children on earth, have bodies completely full of viruses and bacteria. And if you actually sterilize a human body of its viruses and bacteria, the human dies. Because actually, the viruses and bacteria outnumber human cells in any human being on the order of 100 to 1. So if what is a vaccine? It simply is a dead version of a virus or a dead version of a bacteria. And if your body can absorb the millions and trillions of bacterial and viral assaults a child's body is exposed to every second of every day, it can certainly handle a vaccine. It's just the same thing. It's the same phenomenon. So this is all just hocus pocus. It's hocus pocus like saying somehow Gorgonzola cheese causes you to have more colds.
Again, Laurie Garrett is a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. She is a Pulitzer Prize winner and authority on epidemics and contagious diseases. Her books include I Heard the Sirens Scream. And Laurie Garrett, once again, it's always good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Warren.
Once again, the outbreak occurred, this current outbreak, in Orange County, which is where Disneyland is located in Southern California. Matthew Zahn is Medical Director for Epidemiology at the Orange County Healthcare Agency. Dr. Zahn, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
How serious is this?
Well, for the people experiencing disease, it's certainly very serious. If you put this outbreak in context for Orange County, for the 5 years before, as Dr. Garrett mentioned, last year we had an outbreak that really resolved, but now we've had another measles outbreak. Before these last couple of years, we either have zero or one case of measles each year. So basically none. What would happen was someone, occasionally a resident, would travel to another country and come back and have measles get counted as a case, but that was it. So now we're at 23 cases so far this year for the first several weeks of January. And we are continuing to have to see suspect cases. In all likelihood, we will have more cases. So in the larger scheme of things, this is a big outbreak for measles for us.
Now, apparently people at Disneyland or who were at Disneyland during those 4 days in December have gone to other places. And there are now isolated cases in several other states and one in Mexico. Do you attribute all of those to the same incident? Laura Garrett said there was a second outbreak in Orange County as well as the one at Disneyland.
That's a good question. To be clear, last year we had, in the first several months of the year, an outbreak of measles. Really, that resolved by the end of March. So we had went 9 months with no cases at all. So I really don't feel like this is an ongoing, low-lying illness. It was gone. A new event has begun. Proving that all of these cases are associated with the one Disneyland beginning, that can be a hard thing to be sure of. But putting the whole picture together, really we have a new introduction of a new event beginning at the beginning of the year in Disneyland, and that's all of these cases now are really springing from that event. Really testifies to how infectious the virus is and how quickly one event can just spread into something bigger.
So as you're saying then, it is so contagious that when a lot of people get together in the same place, particularly when they come from different countries, as such as they do at Disneyland, I take it that would be a perfect petri dish.
Yeah, it's a reasonable way for it to happen. And certainly, in Southern California, by no means is Disneyland the only venue where you can imagine this to be a reality. The fact of the matter that we have large numbers of international travelers coming to Southern California and to the United States, which is a wonderful thing that we love. But the potential certainly is for the virus to be introduced to the community, and in a situation where a large number of people become exposed over a short period of time, it can grow.
And I understand that you can be exposed if you're in a room where somebody was who had measles 2 hours before you got there.
Yeah, that's a reality. I think the first hour afterwards even seems to be more of a risk than the second hour, but your point is well taken that in terms of how the virus is passed, it is about as infectious as a virus gets. Certainly being in close contact with someone who has measles is the best way for the virus to be passed, so to speak, but simply sharing the same air of the same room for any period of time puts you at risk for becoming infected.
The Washington Post has called Orange County, your county, a hotbed of the anti-vaccine movement, attributing it in part to Dr. Bob Sears, a popular doctor there who recommends delaying the vaccination schedule. Do you agree with that?
Well, you know, I think that Orange County is probably a very good representation of what you see around the country. We certainly have overall, our immunization rates are very good. We're fine with our immunization rates. I do think we distinctly have areas within our county where we have lower immunization rates because of vaccine hesitancy as, you know, being one of the major players. And so we deal with those issues. Those issues, I think, certainly put our community at risk for outbreaks in a way that they don't need to be. I don't think that that issue is something that they're not dealing with all over the country. In many parts of the country, you have communities or areas where immunization rates are lower. So if you have introduction of a virus like measles, you have a potential for a problem.
And I take it Orange County is typical in the sense that vaccine hesitancy is most common in upper-class neighborhoods, high-income neighborhoods where people have a lot of education.
Yeah, if you just look at Orange County from a, you know, from a 30,000 foot level, as you move south in our county, affluency, higher socioeconomic status is more common. As you move south in our county, our immunization rates drop.
And I take it at the some of the schools in Orange County, as a result of what's happened over the past few weeks, kids who have not been vaccinated have been told to stay home.
Yeah, that's right. We've had one incident in a high school here where we have had a case, and we have worked with that school to assess the immunization status for all of the children in that school. Again, referring back to what you'd mentioned before, this is an extremely infectious virus, and so you can imagine if a child who is sick is in the school, there's a very good chance that over several days, virtually everybody's potentially exposed. So for children who have not been immunized, there's a real potential for getting sick, and they were excluded from school.
Well, what about this situation at Disneyland where people, once again, from all over the place come and who have apparently carried measles to other states? Are they likely to infect other people, or have they been identified to the point where you think that the outbreak can be controlled?
Well, the outbreak certainly can be controlled. It is a tremendous amount of public health work. And so what happens is as soon as we have cases in our county or in other counties in the state or in other states around the country, as soon as any local health department recognizes a case of measles, the goal then becomes to identify anyone who could have been around them while they were infectious, which can be for several days. So that means identifying family members, identifying work sites, figuring out schools where they could have been, social situations they could have been. So even one case will result in hundreds of people potentially being exposed. Public health has to follow up and identify all these people, make sure none of them have been getting sick, and give them vaccine or protect them if needed. It certainly can be done in terms of protecting an event, but it involves an awful lot of catch-up. A whole lot easier if people are immunized and protected from getting sick in the first place.
All right. Matthew Zahn, once again, Medical Director for Epidemiology at the Orange County Healthcare Agency. Once again, Orange County, California is where Disneyland is located, and that's where this latest outbreak is said to have begun during 4 days in December. And again, it is clearly being spread, as we just heard. We're going to talk a bit more about the vaccine hesitancy movement, as Matthew Zahn called it. First, we'll take a brief break on our talking point. Can Facebook crack down on fake news without silencing satire? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
We're on Only Back with To The Point, talking today about the outbreak of measles starting at Disneyland in Orange County, California, spreading to a few other states. There are now something like 70 cases, or a few more than 70 cases. Last year in this country, there were 644. One hopes, of course, that this outbreak won't be as bad as that one. Earlier on our program, we heard from Laurie Garrett at the Council on Foreign Relations, who has studied infectious diseases and epidemics around the world, say that Africa is doing a better job than the United States at the moment at coping with what is a vaccine-preventable disease. And she attributed that in part to doctors who feel that parents ought to be able to give their to have a choice as to when their children are vaccinated. One doctor who does, in fact, give his patients a choice, or his parents' patients a choice, is Jay Gordon, who is a pediatrician based in Santa Monica, where our station, KCRW, is also located. Dr. Gordon, thank you for being on our program.
Thank you for inviting me, Warren.
What's the case for parental choice, and how do you respond to what we heard from Laurie Garrett, that the idea that kids can't handle all of that a virus or bacteria in their bodies at the same time is what she referred to as hocus pocus?
I think that parents should participate in all large medical decisions, including vaccination. I think that when we coerce parents, we lose the ability to communicate. Coercion interferes with communication, and it's going to interfere with herd immunity. If parents feel pressured to give six vaccines at a time when they're not comfortable, they may pull away completely from the doctor, from medical care in general. And I think that if we talk with them and offer information and then allow them to participate in this decision, we're going to retain herd immunity better than if we coerce. Dr. Garrett gave a lot of misinformation. I'm sorry to have to correct it right away, but the majority of cases of measles are not in the United States. There are millions of cases of measles worldwide, and in countries with lesser health and lesser health care, there are a lot of fatalities. The last fatal case of measles in the United States was 11 years ago. It is a nasty illness. I don't want to see measles come back. The injection is not a killed virus. It's a live virus, an attenuated virus vaccine. Theoretically, a little more dangerous than a killed vaccine, but not a dangerous vaccine. It's just that I think that we could give it at a better time than at 12 months of age.
What about the concern that's been raised by not just Dr. Garrett, but also Dr. Gazan at the Orange County Healthcare Agency, that and raised by others as well, that the more people who don't get vaccines and don't get them in time, the more likely we are to have measles?
They are correct. The parents who don't give their children vaccinations are putting them at increased risk for measles. And I think they have the right to decide on the timing of that vaccine. The children at age 12 months are certainly not at high risk for getting measles. They're not socializing. The children at 6 or 8 weeks of age don't belong at Disneyland. Immunocompromised children who are at risk aren't going to go to Disneyland either. Their oncologists will keep them away from Disneyland. But I just feel that the coercive atmosphere, which is increasing dramatically, is going to interfere with herd immunity and not help herd immunity.
In California, there is a law that does allow people to not vaccinate their children if they so choose. But recently, that law was amended, and now if they make that choice, they have to confer with a doctor. Is that a good idea?
Well, in theory, it's a good idea. It removed, there is really no personal beliefs exemption in California anymore because it has to be signed by a healthcare professional. But it's not a bad idea to have people get more information. I think that there could come a time when some doctors will refuse to sign that, when they'll say, you know, if you are refusing vaccinations, clearly I haven't given you enough information, so good luck getting into kindergarten. That hasn't happened yet, but I think it could happen. I'm concerned about making personal beliefs exemptions more difficult to get because, again, it's coercive. Everybody talks about high-income areas being hotbeds of low vaccination rates. I look at it more as high education and high information areas. There are plenty of wealthy people who vaccinate their children fully. As a matter of fact, I think that all parents, almost all parents, would like to vaccinate their children. I think that they look at the timing, six vaccines, a hepatitis B vaccine at birth, and six vaccines at 2 months of age, and six more at 4 months of age, and then a triple live virus and a chickenpox vaccine at 12 months of age, and they don't like the timing. And at the very least, they want to talk about it and find out exactly why we, the medical community, believe that is the best time. And I think they would like us to listen to them if they don't feel it's the right time.
We have seen the comments by some doctors to the effect that it's okay if you delay the vaccination of your child because everybody else is vaccinating their child, therefore the chance of getting measles is much less than it might be. Do you subscribe to that idea?
I think it's a selfish but realistic point of view. I think that if every 3-year-old child or every 2-year-old child received a measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, herd immunity would rise. It's already high enough. It would rise, and measles would drop back down to a very, very low incidence disease. It is, as it is, actually, it's a very low incidence disease. But I think that, again, if we allowed parents to participate more fully instead of bullying them on the internet and in person, that we'd get more vaccines.
I'm going to interrupt because I think you made the point. I want to go on to another guest, although, of course, we invite you to stay with us. Jay Gordon, again, pediatrician based in Santa Monica, supporter of the idea of personal belief exemptions for parents when it comes to vaccination for measles. Aaron Carroll is a doctor, professor of pediatrics, and associate dean for research mentoring at Indiana's University School of Medicine. He is a regular contributor to the New York Times, blogs about health policy at the Incidental Economist. Dr. Carroll, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What's your view about the personal belief exemption and the concern that Dr. Gordon expresses about coercion?
Well, nobody wants to coerce. And in fact, I think that there's very few pediatricians who would not welcome a discussion. The problem is that there's a general feeling that there are physicians and other experts out there who will sort of endorse the idea that, first of all, it's okay to delay the vaccines and that is a quote-unquote rational choice or something people could consider. You know, just running through some of the numbers of things we've discussed, you know, everybody, you know, I think Dr. Gordon talked about the numbers of vaccines we give today versus in the past, and is it too many? But it's important to understand that it's not the numbers of shots, but the numbers of antigens or things in the vaccine that the body has to react to. The old smallpox vaccine had about 200 antigens. In the 1980s, the 7 vaccines we gave had about 2,000 antigens in them today. But today's 11 vaccines have only about 125 antigens. In fact, they are much better. We've refined them and made the process so much better that kids have to sort of have a much lower immune response to the many vaccines today than they did the few vaccines in the past. So it's not an unreasonable number. In fact, we're exposing them to far less than they used to. And as your first guest said, the body is more than capable of reacting to all of those shots. It reacts, you know, it has the capability to react to almost 10,000 vaccines at any given moment. We're always inundated by things. So this isn't too much for any child. I also want to respond to the idea that, you know, that young kids are not at risk. It's important for us to understand that at least 6 of the cases of measles going on right now are in kids who are too young to be vaccinated. Because herd immunity is not just about protecting the kids who get vaccines, but protecting those who can't protect themselves. And the reason that we start at 1 year of age is because that's the lowest we can really do it. But kids less than that are at risk. And unless we get everybody else vaccinated and protected and get the herd immunity that we need, those who are at most risk, the elderly, the immunocompromised, and yes, even babies, are very much at increased risk. And we're seeing that in this outbreak. This is not a mild disease. About a quarter of the kids that have gotten diagnosed have been hospitalized at this time. 80% of the children who have gotten sick are unvaccinated. A significant number of the rest of them are undervaccinated, haven't had sort of all the boosters that they need. This is a preventable illness. It's also one of the most infectious diseases out there. You know, we worry about Ebola. The average infected Ebola person can infect about 2 other people. Influenza, 2 to 3 people. Smallpox may be 5 to 7, but the average person infected with measles will likely infect about 18 other people because it is one of the most infectious diseases out there. It's why we need vaccination. It's why we need herd immunity, and it's why we need everybody to get vaccinated and vaccinated on time.
So if you think it is not then a rational choice to delay the vaccine, why do you think it is that it's most common in places where people are highly educated?
Well, I think that there's a lot of misinformation spread, and there's a lot of misinformation spread amongst high-educated people, and the idea that, you know, it's not a big deal, or that they hear that that you know there are risks associated with it, or there are problems, or they believe, you know, things about vaccines and autism, which have been totally, at this point, debunked. And I think that they believe that the things that they hear, because they're highly educated, that are correct. And there's also a very rational human response to see an association and make a causation. And, you know, the times when kids get vaccines and have been to the doctor are times when adults are more likely to watch their children closely afterwards because they've heard about problems with vaccines. And then they might notice behaviors, and they might notice them for the first time at the same time that they got a vaccine, and therefore they assign a link, but one did not cause the other. We have, you know, the last big systematic review, I think, had 5 randomized controlled trials, 27 cohort studies, 17 case control studies, and 15 other studies looking at about 14.7 million children who have had research done on them, and we cannot find the link between vaccines and autism. And for people who say we need more research, I would say, how much more? What more do you want? How many more studies would convince you?
Dr. Aaron Carroll, again, at Indiana University. Let me go back to Dr. Jay Gordon in Santa Monica. Have you actually seen evidence of harm? I don't think you buy into the autism idea, but have you seen evidence of harm that has been caused by vaccinations given for measles, given to children that were under a year of age?
You're talking about the measles vaccine given at a year of age.
Yeah.
I have secondhand information.
I
have parents who have come to see me for a second or third opinion who feel that their children were 100% normal. They have the video. They show me the video at 6 months of age and 9 months of age and 12 months of age. And then they show me a video of the child shortly after he or she received the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. There isn't good medical research supporting that. There's anecdotal evidence. But Dr. Garrett mentioned how 40 years ago she had a child die in her arms of measles. This appeals to this is a very emotional appeal. I can tell you that I have sat face-to-face with people who say my child was normal until he received the MMR vaccine. I don't think that this is solid enough evidence to change the schedule or to eliminate the vaccine or to claim that the MMR causes autism. It's not solid enough evidence, but it is impressive when 100 people tell you the same story. It is impressive. I don't believe that Andrew Wakefield's study was good enough. Okay, I think we were correct to move it out of the medical literature. But anecdotal evidence needs to be listened to. Parents need to be listened to, and that's all that I'm saying.
Well, let me give Dr. Carroll an opportunity to respond to that. Incidentally, I don't believe that Laura Garrett, our first guest, is in fact a medical doctor. Aaron Carroll, back to you.
So I would say that the plural of anecdote is not data. And I do not doubt that there are people out there who believe that the timing of the vaccine was at the same or related in some way to the timing of when they noticed their child having some aggressive disorders. The thing that matters, though, is whether there are more kids who have those kinds of aggressive disorders who get vaccines than there are kids who don't get vaccines. And the research tells us no, that yes, that there is, that there are a certain number of people who notice these kinds of symptoms at the same time the vaccine occurs, but they notice them no more regularly than people who don't get the vaccine, and it's not causal. We don't have any evidence at all.
But should there be more research?
I'm sorry?
Should there be more research? That's what
again,
Dr. Gordon suggested.
Again, we have all of those studies I just described with more than 14.7 million children. That research cost tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. How many more studies do you need? That is more studies and more people involved than probably any other drug that we take. And it says over and over and over again that in 14.7 million kids, we can't detect the relationship. And if you can't detect the relationship in that many children, do we really expect we'll see it in another study of 5 or 10,000? It's not going to show up. And so it's very difficult for scientists to look at this and say, what more can we do? You know, how else can we convince people who still refuse to believe after that much research that there is no not only association but causation?
Dr. Aaron Carroll, professor of pediatrics, associate dean for research mentoring at Indiana University's School of Medicine, also once again a regular contributor to the New York Times, a blogger at The Incidental Economist. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
I want to go back to Matthew Zahn, again, the medical director for epidemiology at the Orange County Healthcare Agency. Obviously, there is argument about this issue. Were some of the kids or some of the people who got measles at Disneyland or as a result of being at Disneyland or being exposed to somebody who was at Disneyland, people who had, in fact, been vaccinated?
Well, you see two groups. One is the kids. And for the kids, overwhelmingly, it's kids who've never been vaccinated. Okay, we have 10 kids over the last 2 years who have developed measles. And as part of those two different outbreaks, one of them had received the vaccine. All the rest of them had not. For the adult population, it's more of a mixed bag. We will more often have adults who are vaccinated. Many times what happens is by the time you're 30 or 40 or 50, you just don't remember if you've been vaccinated or not. So they kind of fit in the category of some vaccinated, some think maybe they have, but they don't really remember. So for the pediatric population, it is kids who are not being vaccinated. Are they all vaccine hesitancy or vaccine refusers? Some of them are, some of them are not, but that's certainly part of the issue.
Should adults get vaccinated for measles?
Yeah, I think people have to realize it becomes a numbers game. So in events like these, what is happening is one person who is very infectious is exposing hundreds and hundreds of people. Of those hundreds and hundreds of people, if you have a vaccine that is 99% good, if you have 1 in 100, 1% failure rate, you will have occasionally cases, and that's what we see here. For the limited number of adults who end up getting sick after they've been vaccinated, and again, you're talking very small numbers, the people don't get as sick, and important for us in public health, they don't pass around the virus. So the people who are real sick, the people who are shedding and infecting a large number of other people, those are people who have not been vaccinated before. The vaccine works.
So should people around the country be worried about this outbreak here in California?
You know, I think the biggest reason we raise the issue is, are we talking about large number of cases? No, you should keep this in perspective. Compared to the number of flu cases that you have out there right now, it's nothing compared to that. But why is it important from a public health standpoint? We have a silver bullet. We have a way to protect it. We have a way to keep people from getting sick. If people are out there thinking about this event, they don't have to sit and worry. They can think, if I've been vaccinated, I'm safe. If I want to protect my child, I should get my child vaccinated and get them vaccinated on time. I think I would mention, you know, as to what Dr. Gordon is mentioning, you know, for our kids, we have consistently seen last year and this year, kids under 3 years of age who have gotten sick. They are older than one. They are under four. They were in the age group where they should have gotten that one MMR. They have not had not gotten it for a variety of reasons, some of them very legitimate, some of them vaccine refuser. But those are the kids that have gotten sick, and that disease could have been prevented if they had been vaccinated. And
okay.
So, you know, it's not just getting vaccinated. It's getting vaccinated on time.
Medical Dr. Matthew Zahn, Medical Director for Epidemiology at the Orange County Healthcare Agency in California. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Jay Gordon, MD, based here in Santa Monica, and our earlier guest, Laurie Garrett, at the Council on Foreign Relations as well. Facebook and other social media have become sources of news and also of satire, which is often false, even though it reads like news. Facebook is worried that its credibility is at stake, and it's asking its users to separate fact from fiction. Back with that in a moment on To the Point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Warren Olney back with today's Talking Point. Actor Macaulay Culkin is dead. Paul Krugman has declared bankruptcy. Sarah Palin has joined Al Jazeera America. These are all examples of the kind of fake news that appears on Facebook's news feed, where it often goes viral. Facebook wants that to change. Marcus Wilson is a former AP reporter. He's now senior writer for Wired, and he's author of Biopunk, DIY Scientists Hack the Software of Life. Marcus, good to have you with us.
Hey, good to be here.
So the key here, I guess, is that whether these things are true or not, they get shared, and that's what makes them go viral.
Exactly right, and the more provocative, the more they get shared, and once that cycle starts, it's really hard to stop it. And I think that for a lot of us, because these things are being shared by our friends, we have a natural tendency to want to believe them.
So what is Facebook asking its users to do?
Well, Facebook has long had a way for you to flag any post that you see for various reasons. Something is pornographic, it advocates violence. And now when you click on that menu to report a post, Facebook is giving you a new option, which allows you to say that it's a false news story. And they are doing this because of the proliferation of the kinds of stories you mentioned at the top. These things that sound true, they sound like regular news, but they are in fact completely made up.
There was a columnist at the Washington Post who fell for the story that Sarah Palin had joined Al Jazeera America. The paper had to run a correction.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I can't say for certain that this reporter first encountered this bit of news on Facebook, but it does go to show how powerful some of these sites have become, these sites that are out there publishing these stories, some of them in the name of satire, some of them don't even seem to even make that pretense. At a time when the name of the game in online publishing is getting clicks, because the more traffic you get, the more ads you can sell, the more ad impressions you make, there's a strong incentive to get traffic by any means possible. And so it was only a matter of time before somebody said, well, satire sites like The Onion get lots of clicks for posting fake news stories. So let's go and do the same thing, but let's take it a step further. We won't even really bother to do the work of making them into satire. We'll just say things that aren't true so that people will come and check it out.
If enough people, or if more and more people, label something as fake, will it then, because of the algorithms that Facebook uses, slowly disappear from the news feed?
That's what Facebook says they're going to do. And they seem to be placing a lot of trust in the wisdom of the crowd on this one. Basically, the way they describe it, the more a post gets flagged, the less and less often it will show up in people's news feeds, basically, to curb its virality. What's interesting to me is that they aren't saying that they're actually going to delete it. In other words, Facebook is not saying we're going to be the ultimate referee of whether something is true or not. We're just going to rely on sort of the momentum of the crowd as it more and more people see something and decide that as far as they know, it's not true.
Is there a risk here of a sort of mass censorship of satire, for example, that people for some political reason don't approve of?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out and sort of how much Facebook tells us, what's happening as far as this goes. They actually said in their announcement of this new feature that their testing showed that satire wasn't affected, genuine satire, that when something actually deserved that label, it wasn't being clicked on as often by users as being false. But what strikes me is that, especially given how polarized politics are in the U.S. around issues like, say, climate change or vaccines, like you were talking about in the last segment, there seems to be it seems like there's a danger that people will start calling stories false out of a political motive rather than because they're actually concerned about the accuracy of it. You know, if you're on the right, you'll say a New York Times story is false. If you're on the left, you'll say a Fox News story is false. I will say, though, that while that danger is there, you know, Facebook is a pretty sophisticated operation, and they have a really large group of users to sort of test these things out on. And so, you know, it's possible that they seem to be confident enough in how they've evaluated how this works to believe that this won't happen, that even if people have these ulterior motives or they start flagging onion stories, that they're still just not going to do it to the extent that people are willing and eager to do it for stuff that's actually false.
You use the term genuine satire, though. Who's going to decide what is genuine satire? Do we have a consensus definition of that?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that in a way, it's smart for Facebook to just let the rest of us figure that out. I mean, you know, satire is something that is always going to be defined to a certain extent by cultural norms. And, you know, of course, around, you know, the Charlie Hebdo shootings, now this is a huge topic of conversation. So, you know, again, as with the other sort of, you know, political dimensions of this, I mean, that, in a way, that's kind of the ultimate test. You put one of those covers up on Facebook, and I'll just say it'd be very interesting to see how that would play out if you could actually raise the curtain on how you can see that from the back end on Facebook.
Some really tricky issues having to do, as you have indicated, with free speech, really getting into it in a way that is very interesting in this technological age. Marcus Wolfson, again, with Wired, author of Biopunk, DIY Scientist, Hack the Software of Life, formerly with the AP. Thanks a lot for being with our program.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
To the Point, produced this week by Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Benjamin Gottlieb, Jenny Hamill, and Claire Martin. Our technical director is Mike Newport, senior producer Evan George, managing producer Sonia Geis. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.